This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. It has become a bit of a tradition to start celebrating important films that have milestone anniversaries. While 45 years isn't exactly a banner year, we are looking at a film I had never seen before, and one that returning guest Brody Cottenham is a massive fan of and has been peer pressuring me to watch for a while. So this seemed like as good of a time as any to finally watch 1978's Halloween. After last being heard on episode 245, Make Remake, The Day the Earth Stood Still, welcome back to the show, Brody. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Dakota. Thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Are you happy that your peer pressure finally worked and you managed to get me to watch this horror classic?
I'd like to think of it as just friendly, you know, engagement more than peer pressure.
Oh, you know, I've been feeling it real hard. I've been talking to my therapist about it, and it's like, oh, this guy Brody, he just keeps pestering me. He keeps posting memes and keeps doing all this stuff and making me want to watch this. What's the deal? How should I do it? And my therapist was like, you know what? You should just finally watch the movie and stop being a little crybaby.
Listen, Matthew said the same thing. We've all told you. Exposure therapy is the only way you're going to get over this, man.
Well, I'm glad I did finally watch it and we get to have this conversation. It was basically just a reason to do this episode was to watch that movie. So I'm pretty excited. When I every year I look at what movies have milestone years, and like I said, 45 years isn't that crazy, but seeing Halloween on there, it was like, you know what? Finally, I'll watch it this year and have Brody on to discuss it.
Well, I'm super, super excited you did, and I'm very much looking forward to talking about it.
All right, then let's get into this.
Halloween night. A small American town. 15 years ago. Michael? Halloween.
I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
The Halloween franchise has gone in a bunch of different directions over the course of 13 films, including 2 main timelines, a standalone duo of movies from Rob Zombie, a trilogy of requels from David Gordon Green, and of course the infamous Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, which has literally nothing to do with the franchise other than its name. But back in 1978, it was just a John Carpenter with $300,000 making a passion project. Carpenter at the time had made a student film that managed to gain distribution in Dark Star and the low-budget cult hit Assault on Precinct 13. He was 30 years old and was a fan of the Canadian horror movie Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark, and its burgeoning subgenre, which is now known as slashers. And after gaining the blessing of Clark, Carpenter made his own version of a holiday horror flick. With such a tiny budget, the producers tried to find a well-known actor to bring in audiences. Both Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee were asked to play the Dr. Loomis part, but turned it down due to the low pay. Donald Pleasance, who is most known as playing the most iconic version of Blofeld in the Bond film You Only Live Twice, was eventually cast. After originally trying to get a different Nepo baby, Jamie Lee Curtis, the daughter of Vivian Lee of Psycho fame, and Tony Curtis, was brought in to play the lead Laurie Strode. For anyone who isn't familiar with the Halloween plot, it follows Michael Myers, who at 6 years old stabs his sister to death and is sent to a mental institution. After 15 years locked up, Michael escapes and returns to his hometown of Haddonfield. Michael's doctor, Sam Loomis, seems to be the only person aware of Michael's psychotic nature, how he is a soulless killing machine with no understanding of right or wrong, and tries to track him down. Michael starts stalking some teenagers, including Laurie Strode. While Laurie is babysitting her neighbor, her best friend Linda is attacked and killed by Michael, along with a few more of Laurie's friends. Eventually, Michael turns his sights onto Laurie as well. It is typical for a 45th anniversary to give the gift made from sapphires, with the stone being associated with loyalty, royalty, and sincerity. Since the film is so old, there will be no spoiler warning, as everything is fair game. So Brody, As the preeminent Halloween fan, I want to know, how loyal are you to this film, and can you sincerely tell me that is the king of horror movies?
I mean, I certainly think when it comes to the slasher genre, there's not a lot that you would put above it, if any. I mean, certainly, you talked about Jamie Lee Curtis's mother. You know, Psycho was one that kind of set a template. Black Christmas, especially as Canadians, I don't think it's one we kind of, you know, big up enough, because it certainly was very influential. But I think if you look at a lot of the stuff, I mean, Dario Argento was doing things around this time or shortly after in Italy too, that have held up really well. But certainly Halloween was kind of, I think it really came along at a very sort of important time and influential time, because then you got, you know, the Friday the 13th series and Nightmare on Elm Street series and a lot of others that kind of followed in its footsteps.
I was wondering if you can tell me when was the first time you had watched Halloween, and sort of what was your reactions to it back then?
It's funny, because it is one of those movies. It was the first actual horror movie that I saw. I mean, we're both of a similar age, so, you know, we grew up with, you know, Goosebumps or Ghostbusters, or I remember having Nightmare Before Christmas on VHS. Like, I was very much into, like, you would call it gateway horror stuff. And so I just remember the first time I saw Halloween, it was the first actual horror movie. And I remember the movie as much as why I ended up seeing it, which was, I was about 12 and we're going down to a family wedding in Southern Ontario. And in the car, my mom had a copy of People magazine with this big cover article, was 25 scariest movies of all time. So I read the article, and then we get down to my uncle's place that night where we were staying. And that night he asked us, oh, do you guys want to rent a movie? So it was his two boys and my sister and I, and I'm the oldest. So, you know, especially at that age, you're kind of like the de facto ringleader. So I was like, oh, hey, I get the bright idea. Why don't we rent one of these movies? And I show my cousins this article, and we look at all these scary movies. And so my uncle takes us to the video store, much to my sister's chagrin. My poor sister, I don't think to this day you could get her to watch one of those movies. But my cousins were really excited. So we go to the video store, and the first one that we saw that was on this list was Halloween. And I still remember seeing it there, grabbing it on VHS and being like, okay, this is on the list. Let's watch this one. And then we go back to my uncle's place. We watched it. And I just remember sitting there watching it. You know, we're in the living room. And it was just, you know, my cousins and I were watching it. The adults were, you know, off doing something. My sister didn't want to watch it. So we're just sitting there, and I was just the whole time transfixed, right? Like, it was so different, obviously, than other movies you'd seen, because I'd never seen like a legit horror movie like this. And I remember just being enthralled the whole time. And then that night, I just remember crashing on a mattress in my cousin's bedroom, and every little noise just perked you up. And you're like, what was that?
That's really funny. So you all thought Michael was maybe there stalking you guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I imagine since that time, you've watched it many times over since.
Yeah, I'd say the last 8 to 9 years, I usually watch it on Halloween.
Oh, nice. Well, makes perfect sense. We just passed Friday the 13th, so I decided to watch Friday the 13th for the first time. Sometimes there's movies like that in our cultural significance that, like, it just makes sense to watch it on certain days. So watching a movie on Halloween called Halloween makes perfect sense.
Can't go wrong.
Now, what about the rest of the franchise? Have you seen any, all of them? Were you a fan of any of the reboot, either the Rob Zombie or the David Gordon Green ones?
Yeah, I've seen pretty much all of them in the franchise. Three I've only kind of seen. You mentioned it, and it's interesting because it's got kind of its own cult following, just because originally the whole thing was, and John Carpenter and Deborah Hill talked about this, they wanted to set it up as sort of an anthology, right? Like, it wasn't supposed to be all about Michael Myers. Like, they want to do different story every year, and sometimes they'd be connected, sometimes they wouldn't. That was the whole idea. But then Halloween 3 came out, and it didn't do particularly well, which is why they brought Michael Myers back. That's why 4 is called The Return of Michael Myers, because, you know, the old line says, you know, the answer to all your questions is money. And so, you know, Michael Myers made money. So that's why they brought him back. I've seen the first Rob Zombie one. I wasn't big on it. And then I've seen the new David Gordon Green ones, which I really liked the first one they did of the new trilogy. The other two I wasn't as big on, but I did like that one. And even Halloween 2, I mean, it's not as good as the first one, but I think it's pretty good as well.
it's funny. I feel like the Halloween franchise and the fan base is so divisive over who likes what movies, how they feel about the different ones. I know some people feel the Rob Zombie ones are just, you know, utter blasphemy, and some people really appreciate that he tried doing its own thing. And then same thing with the David Gordon Green ones, where there is this real cult following of like, I really like the social angle he's trying to say with these movies. And some people are like, no, you really lose the plot, trying to do too much, going off in weird directions, all this sort of stuff. How can you make these characters that we know and love so well do these things? And then of course, the fact that like, if you go on, search up Halloween on Wikipedia, they actually have a flow chart of what the timeline is for the franchise. And you could basically, it's basically a choose your own adventure, because there's so many different ways you can go, where basically every movie sort of retcons the previous one.
Yeah. Well, and you look at H2O in there as well, right?
Yeah, yeah, because you kind of have like the original ones that sort of exclude number three, and then like the original one leading up to H2O, and then like those, you know, few films, they are kind of their own timeline as well. And then the original leads into the David Gordon Green remake, which is its own trilogy and all that sort of stuff. So it's kind of crazy how all over the place it is. And I just love watching the discourse of Halloween fans just argue with each other about which movies are the good ones and which ones are the bad ones, because it seems like literally no two people have the same opinion.
No, and you'll have to get Callum's opinion, because I'm pretty sure he's big into the Rob Zombie ones, so I'm sure he will weigh in.
Really? Okay. Well, Callum, I hope you're listening. I know your horror takes are always kind of all over the place. I always respect you. So, Callum, if you're listening to this, please let me know what you believe is the definitive Halloween rankings. I'd be very curious to hear. If anyone doesn't know, Callum McNabb hosts the excellent horror podcast, Scare Traducing. It's currently on a hiatus, but still go back and listen to his episodes as well. I'm pretty sure he's done several Halloween podcasts too.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about this movie then, 1978. You know, it's, I talk about how, I mentioned how it was made for only $300,000, and while in 1978, $300,000 is a lot today, it wasn't that much back then. Like, this movie really was a shoestring budget film. You can sort of tell at times where they're like, all right, we're really going to shoot this on the fly. It's going to be run and gun. You know, it's not going to be, you know, perfectly clean and perfect. It's not like it's a Wes Anderson movie where everything, you know, has deeper symbolic meaning. We're just going to capture what we can get and sort of hope for the best. And luckily, John Carpenter is one of those directors who just has such a good innate sense of how to make a film feel real and bring this world to life, that it all sort of works out, where it's really hard to sort of nitpick any of his direction. I do have to say, though, I wasn't as scared as I thought I was going to be. And it's interesting because, you know, we've got like these, a couple really gruesome murders and things like that. But for the most part, you know, Michael Myers is just sort of standing there. It's not like we're getting jump scares. It's not like, you know, it's just the feeling of dread throughout it, which is very different than, you know, the feeling of fear. So I imagine when you probably watched it as a first time as a kid, if I had watched it too as a kid, it probably would have been absolutely terrifying for me. I probably wouldn't have been able to sleep for weeks, but I watched it and I was like, oh, that was kind of a fun movie. I liked it, but it didn't really terrify me in the way I think a lot of people probably will have watched it if they watched it at a seminal age.
Yeah. And I think also just given our age and what we've seen and what's come out since then, is everything has kind of tried to take strides forward into being like, how can we make this more gruesome or more scary, or, you know, things like that, right? Because I mean, you look at a lot of the tropes, it's, you know, the one scene where Annie goes back to the car, we see that the car's locked. She goes inside, grabs the keys, and they make a point of showing us this. Then she goes out, and the car, she doesn't even open the, like, she just opens the car, she doesn't put the key in. You know, that kind of thing has just become, you know, sort of trope. Whereas back then, that would have been, you know, scarier. The idea of that would have been more, you know, viscerally frightening, I guess, because, you know, if you've seen a lot of the slashers or horror stuff that's come out since then, this kind of paved the way for that. And I mean, there was other, like, you look at something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which came out before this, which was, you know, more probably bloody and stuff like that. It was a different, you know, type of slasher. So it those types of movies existed, but to your point, I think it's that sense of dread and just how well Carpenter keeps the tone throughout the movie that really sets it apart. Because he didn't need, you know, to be gruesome or overly graphic or anything like that. And he just had that unsettling feeling, which I think speaks a lot to your point of just the direction, and I'm sure in part the budget too, but just how brilliant he was as a director, that he could make this creepy, unsettling feeling just by pointing the camera, just by, you know, angles, lighting, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like this is a movie that is unfortunately a bit of a victim of cultural osmosis, in the sense of I've seen the infamous scene of, you know, Michael attacking the closet when Jamie Lee Curtis is inside, you know, he's breaking down the closet door and the light bulb swinging around and he's, you know, she stabs him with the coat hanger. Or, you know, the scene of him hiding, standing by the hedges and then disappearing and stuff like that. You sort of see all that stuff, whether it's being parodied in The Simpsons or stuff like the Scary Movies or things like that,
where you just sort of GIFs online 100 times.
Exactly. Yeah. Where it's just sort of a part of our cultural consciousness where it's so ingrained. We know what's happening and you see it coming. You're like, oh, I know what this scene is. So it sort of takes away the power to scare you. And so it's almost interesting where, like, a lot of times you're like, oh man, I kind of wish I was able to go in blind, but like, I also appreciate all the different references and cultural touchstone points that are happening. But it's definitely a little tricky because, you know, there's so many classic movies, whether, you know, Citizen Kane, Halloween, literally any cultural movie that sort of reached the zenith of pop culture in terms of references, where it basically is sort of spoiled for viewers if you go in to watch something for the first time.
Yeah, well, I'll give a shout out to my buddy Dave. I remember back in university, we used to quote Dumb and Dumber all the time. And he's like, I don't even need to watch this movie because I know all the jokes. I know all the lines, you know, to your point, if that happens, especially with classic movies, like it's Godfather's the same way. People know, you know, all the lines, all these famous moments without ever having seen it because it's become so symbolic culturally. Right. And that, to your point, I absolutely think Halloween does. I mean, if you could call it suffering from that, I think it's personally just a sense of respect and the quality of the movie that can stand the test of time. But to your point, it absolutely happens and people will recognize, you know, Michael Myers, who have never even seen the franchise.
Yeah, for sure. And so I wonder if maybe if I start watching some of the sequels or the other ones, because they aren't as heavily referenced, would they surprise or shock me?
I mean, I think the newer, like, they up the violence and they up Michael, you know, in terms of just his kill count and everything, especially in the newest episodes, like the Rob Zombie one and the David Gordon Green ones, like the kill counts just keep going up and there's just this propensity for Michael to just kill. Whereas the first one kind of seemed more calculated on the way, almost, I guess you'd say. Cause even 4 and 5, 6 weren't quite to the same extent that these ones were. And then if you look at H2O was very specifically, again, him going after Laurie Strode and, you know, some teenagers get in the way of that, but there was a much more focused. Whereas I think in the newer ones, it's just, he's evil and he's a murderer and he just kills whomever's in his path, which I don't ever think was really John Carpenter's intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I'd love to talk about the music. It's, you know, absolutely iconic. John Carpenter composed the music as well. He composed the music for almost all of his films, and he even composed the music for the David Gordon Green trilogy as well. Even though he had nothing to do with the movies at all, he was basically being like, yeah, I'll do the music for your movie. I don't care about what you do in it. It's no longer my franchise, so you do with it as you see fit, but I'll make the music for it. That's fine by me. And he got to work with his son, which I know he was very happy to do with as well. But, you know, the score in Halloween is just so absolutely iconic. This, you know, piano motif, which is like just slightly, I don't want to call it out of tune, but has a sort of eerie quality to it. And the way he plays it is just, you know, so instantly recognizable and familiar. I love it. I love how the movie opens on this music. My only complaint is every time you see Michael, this music pops up, and it pops up a lot, and I feel like it's overdoing it a few times. I've mentioned this a few times on the podcast, but once I saw Guillermo del Toro give a talk at TIFF, talking about gothic horror, specifically Rebecca was the screening that I went to, and he was talking about how he loved the music in Rebecca, but music from that era had an issue with what he called Mickey Mousing, which was, you know, conveying every emotion or feeling that the audience should be feeling on screen. And while I really love the score and what Carpenter is doing, I feel at times, every time Michael pops up, when we get this music, it's a bit Mickey Mousing at times, where it's like, maybe we could use a bit of silence, or, you know, not as, you know, intense of music, so that way we can let the dread in mystery simmer a bit more. How do you feel about the music when you rewatch this film?
That's a good point. Certainly I love the music. It is my ringtone, so I'm a big fan of the song. To your point, yeah, I do think that sometimes, yeah, silence in a weird way speaks volumes. And I think to your point, like the closet scene, it's just Michael breathing and like trying to break in and stuff, right? Like, I don't think there's a lot of music in there. And so, yeah, I think that serves it well. I do think that's certainly a good point. I certainly think it'd be interesting to see if it was dialed back a little bit just in certain spots, or if it would allow you to be, I guess, going in a little more, I don't want to say unprepared, but a little more caught off guard, like, oh, Michael's going to be here now, as opposed to, you know, he's going to be there when the song is playing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I think of, you know, early on in the movie when Laurie's in school, we see a car across the street and the music starts up. And I was like, oh, okay, Michael's across the street watching. And then, of course, the next shot goes back, and sure enough, he's standing there beside the car, and it's like, oh yes, there he is. Stuff like that. So it's just very interesting. I'd love to also kind of go through the different performances. You know, I talked about it, that the two leads in this are Jamie Lee Curtis and Donald Pleasence. Jamie Lee Curtis, it was her first film role. She had acted in some TV work, but never in film. And she was not the original choice of an actress. Originally, Carpenter wanted the daughter of someone that was on the TV show Lassie. I didn't write down the name, so I can't remember who it is. But it's sort of interesting that he wanted someone that had a bit of name attachment to it, and ended up going to Jamie Lee Curtis. I want to talk a bit about the psycho connections later, but for a first film performance, I thought Jamie Lee Curtis was excellent. She really holds her own. She's, you know, very commanding. She offers all these sort of things that you want from a lead character, where she's brave and strong, but also knows when to be scared and terrified and all this sort of stuff, where we get this wide range of emotions, and she's not wooden at all, and sort of goes on to prove that, like, she deservedly became the superstar that she would eventually become, and eventually winning an Oscar last year for Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was like a nice career accomplishment for her. But overall, I was super excited to see that she turns in a really good performance as Laurie in this film.
Yeah, she was great. And it obviously it kicked off a string, especially early in her career. She basically just did horror stuff, right? Including more with John Carpenter. Because she did the sequel to this. She did stuff like The Fog, Prom Night. There's another one too. But yeah, she was really, really great. And I think it's just so perfect as Laurie, right? Like that kind of girl next door, very straight-laced. And you can see her emotions. Like, she wants to protect the kids, or, you know, when she's dealing with her friends, like, she brings everything you needed out of the emotions to the screen. And you can tell, like, she's an intelligent person, like the scene that you kind of talked about earlier, where she's at school. She just speaks very well, comes across as a bright young lady. So I think, yeah, anything and everything that was asked of that character, she did a phenomenal job.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of things, we've got Donald Pleasence, who is playing the doctor chasing down Michael. And I sort of liked how his character, you know, at times he sort of feels like a bit of a kook, where you're not really sure how much you can trust him, especially with the police officer character who's working with him. But I think all those scenes are sort of written well, because we've seen so many horror movies where specifically the kids or adult or the teenagers are not believed about the horror that's happening. The adults sort of ignore them or they're not present at all. Now, granted, this movie, it's a pretty bare bones cast. You can sort of, you know, relegate that to the fact that the budget, they couldn't afford a ton of actors. So it really sort of hyper focuses on only a few characters and locations. But that said, we've got this doctor who's trying to chase down Michael and is trying to communicate what's going on. And the police chief believes him to a degree. Obviously, there is some skepticism, but it's not like the police officer completely dismisses his thoughts and is like, oh, you know what? You're just being crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. Nothing happens. This is a nice small town in the suburbs where no bad things happen, all that sort of stuff. So I think there's a really good written dynamic where there's just enough skepticism, but not enough for the audience to go, okay, like, can we have an adult step up, someone of authority, please? Can something actually happen here? Which I know is a really big trope in horror movies and one that is really frustrating to watch at times. But Donald Pleasance, you know, I mentioned him as probably playing the most iconic version of Blofeld. The reason why he's the most iconic version is because it was later parodied by the other Michael Myers in the Austin Powers movies. So his whole look and feel, like the bald head, the scar over his eye, the, you know, the gray Japanese suit, the high collar sort of thing, and the pinky ring, all that sort of stuff is based on Donald Pleasance's version of Blofeld. I'm currently going through a James Bond watch though, and there's like six different Blofeld actors, and each one is completely different from each other. None of them are the same. Oh, yeah. So it's sort of interesting.
Yeah,
there's
no continuity there.
None whatsoever, which is hilarious. But Donald Pleasance definitely sticks out the most, and you could totally see why Mike Myers would parody him as Dr. Evil later on. But he's really good in this film as this man who's the only one that truly understands what a boogeyman that Michael Myers is.
Oh, absolutely. No, he's phenomenal. And to your point about with Sheriff Brackett there, like, there's the one part where they're standing outside and Sheriff Brackett kind of comes back after doing his rounds or whatever, and he's talking about, okay, you know, some kids threw some eggs at this. Like, you know, there's nothing going on, right? Basically his summation. And then he says, you know, after Dr. Loomis gives him another extremely well-written speech, and to your point, that I think what sets this movie aside, not only from others in the franchise, but just a lot of horror movies in general, is just how well-written the dialogue and the characters are. And so Dr. Loomis gives him this speech about Michael coming back, about how patient he is and this and this. And then to your point, Sheriff Brackett says, you know, okay, more pretty words. And he's like, maybe you're right. And he's like, if you are right, you know, damn you for letting him out. So exactly like you said, he doesn't not believe him, but he's not convinced necessarily. So I like that dynamic where it's like the sheriff is doing his job. Like it drives me nuts, like to your point, in all these movies where it's like it's the incompetent person or police or authority, whoever, teachers, whatever. They just don't believe the kids. They're like, there's nothing to see here. Whereas this is much more like, okay, I'll look into it. I'll do my job. We'll see. And I think that's a much more real reaction, right? And how it would be handled, especially, you know, in the case of an actual medical doctor is telling you this. You have a sense of he has an authority. So when he's talking to another person in a position of authority, they're going to believe each other to an extent. Right. Mm-hmm. And I also like how Dr. Loomis, like, he has those little, like, not a lot of funny moments, but like, there's that one little moment where like he's standing outside the Myers house and the kids run up on the porch and it's like, Lonnie, get your ass out of there. And then the kids run away scared. And you just see this like smile on his face.
Yeah.
So it's like, he's, you know, he's a human being and he's, you know, in the midst of trying to stop something terrible, but to your point, there are those human moments about him and with him that really help his character stand out.
Yeah. There's also a great little moment I like where I believe it's when they're walking through the house, the old Myers house that's now abandoned, and they see a dead animal inside. I believe it's a dead cat. And they hear something and Dr. Loomis pulls out a gun and the cop just kind of looks at him like, who is this guy? And then he pulls out his gun registration. Yeah, he's like, don't worry, I'm licensed to hold carry.
Yeah, I have a permit for this.
And the cop's just like, okay, man, please don't shoot me. Yeah. You kind of seem like a bit of a crank right now.
Yeah. And he said, and that's another part that makes Loomis very human. He's like, are you scared? And he's like, yeah, I kind of guess I am. Like, he's not unafraid. He's not some action hero or something. Like, he's just very human who understands the situation and what he's dealing with. And I think that just makes him a better character, more endearing, certainly someone that stands out, and his performance sells that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the best part about the way the movie is structured is logically everything makes sense. And there's nothing more frustrating when you're watching a horror movie where you're just like, why are you doing this? Have you not thought about this? But what about this? Why are you saying this? This is going against what you said earlier, all this sort of stuff. Throughout the movie, you can consistently see that point A connects to B, connects to C, connects to D, and everything follows a nice logical line where obviously this is a very heightened scenario of this soulless killing machine that's coming to get revenge on his old home and all this sort of stuff and doesn't care who gets in his way, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff is very heightened in what you'd expect from a movie, but at the same time, it's grounded in reality enough that everyone's actions, even when they're scared and are confused, still make sense of like, oh, I understand this is what someone in this situation probably would do or say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's full credit to John Carpenter and Deborah Hill for the script, because it's, like I said, I think it's head and shoulders better written than anything else, not just in that franchise, but most horror movies in general, just because it doesn't have these huge leaps, like you said, in logic, or it doesn't require a ton of suspension of disbelief. I mean, certainly any movie like this, you have a little bit, but not to the lengths that you usually have to go through for something that's, especially even later in the franchise, you know, we'll get more into that later, but there's just a very straightforward, well-done narrative that I think deserves full credit for the writing. Not that I'm biased in any way.
Speaking of the writing, you mentioned both John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. Carpenter wrote the outline for the movie, wrote the script, and then Deborah Hill, who I believe was his girlfriend at the time, came in and basically rewrote all of Laurie's lines, and then John Carpenter sort of focused on reformatting and retooling the Dr. Loomis lines, so that way they kind of both had their own character that they were writing for. And it's a tactic that I sort of really appreciate. I think of something like the Ridley Scott movie The Last Duel, which was written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. They wrote this whole movie, but then they brought in Nicole Holofcener, who came in and rewrote the Jodie Comer part. Specifically, this movie has like a very Rashomon feel where it takes place from different people's perspectives and stuff like that. And then the last perspective is from the woman who does get raped. And so they brought Nicole Holofcener to rewrite her section of the story, so that way it was more authentic coming from a woman. And so I really appreciate movies that where you have someone, doesn't matter if it's a guy or a girl or people of different ethnicities, will sort of look at their work and be like, I know I have a good idea and a good structure here, but I want to make sure that it makes sense for what these characters are speaking. So I'm going to have someone outside come in and help out with that. Obviously, so many movies have script doctors, and we almost never hear about script doctors, about who it was. Usually, if it's someone really famous, it'll later come out and be like, oh yeah, I did a quick pass on this script, blah, blah, blah. We don't really hear much about it, but it's really nice that Carpenter has given so much credit to Deborah Hill for helping to craft the Laurie character and her speeches in particular.
Absolutely. And to your point, The Last Duel, it's a great example of people coming together. You know, you get a lot of different eyes on the script of various types of peoples and opinions, and it helps. And I think I'm sure Deborah Hill also had some input into like Annie and, Linda, yeah, as well, because they just kind of very much the whole, you know, just the three of them just basically seem very much like teenagers of that era, right? Like, you know, they want to hang out with their boyfriends, they're smoking a joint on the way to go babysit, you know, just different things. But they all kind of stood out as unique, right? Like Laurie was kind of the Girl Scout, you know, she had the pumpkin ready to go, she has plans to do stuff with the kids, like she's very much thought it through. Whereas Annie's just basically showing up, you know, she's getting paid to babysit, and then she's going to, you know, try and fool around with her boyfriend whenever he can show up, you know. And the other one's a cheerleader, so she's just, oh, I have this to do tomorrow, and this to do tomorrow, and this to do. So they all were very much their own person, but seemed like real people in their own lane, right? And again, I think that's all about just the writing And I mean, obviously the performances as well, don't get me wrong, they were great. But I think being able to craft unique characters like that, and it kind of set, again, the template for, you know, horror movies going forward in a sense. Like there's that kind of final girl who tends to be the more, you know, down to earth sort of girl next door type person in, you know, pick a movie that followed this, whether it's, you know, the Friday the 13th, whether it's the Screams, etc. Right. Like that kind of very much started that trend and it fell into line after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I also want to talk about continuing the talk about logic, where I appreciate it. The way the kills happened in this movie made sense to not set off all the alarm bells for everything that happens. So obviously, you know, on one side of the story, we've got Lori who's babysitting this young boy. And then across the street is her best friend, Linda, who, you know, goes out and is going to go to see her boyfriend because her boyfriend is home alone. So this is what happens, you know, when she goes to the car and it's locked. So she goes, gets the car keys, comes back, the door is unlocked. Michael's actually in the car and kills her then. But at this point, she has already said that she's going to her boyfriend's house. So we know this is happening. And so when she goes missing, no one thinks anything of it because not enough time has passed. They just all think, oh, she's gone to her boyfriend's to have sex. So you know what? We're going to leave them alone. Let them do their thing. We'll see them when we see them, whether it's later tonight or tomorrow. That's fine. And then Linda's other friend, Annie, comes over with her boyfriend. And that's when they also go, oh, yeah, Linda's just over at her boyfriend's house. So we got her placed to ourselves. And then so when they start dying as well, no one thinks anything of it as either, because you've got this sort of situation where all the logic is making sense. And at this point, Linda's little sister is being watched by Lori as well, so she's not in harm's way. So you get all these situations where the opportunity for someone to find a body or figure out what's going on is sort of removed, but not in a way that makes everything feel like it isn't believable anymore. And so when we finally do get the big reveal of Lori going across the street into her friend's house, and we get this sort of, you know, probably some of the best shots of the reveals of the three bodies inside the house, it works out so great, because that's when all of a sudden all the real fear and tension sort of seeps right into the movie of understanding exactly who we're dealing with in the form of Michael Myers. So I really appreciate the way Carpenter sort of structured it in that regard as well.
Yeah, definitely the last, let's say 20, 25 minutes, it ramps up for sure. And it's interesting too, because you talk about people believing in stuff, and Tommy, when Laurie's babysitting Tommy, he sees Michael after he's just killed Annie. He sees him bring Annie back into the house, right? But because he's been seeing the quote unquote boogeyman and there's nobody there, she doesn't really believe him at first, right? Because Lori's like, oh, Tommy, you know, there's nobody there. You know, don't worry about it. Because to your point, Annie just drops Lindsay off across the street. She's going to see Paul. There's no reason to suspect that, you know, there's anything wrong. And yet we know, because obviously we see what's happening from Tommy's point of view. He's watching him do Michael do this. Which just further adds to the tension in the story later on, because we know that she's going to find the bodies when she gets across the street.
Yeah, Tommy seems to be the only person in this movie that isn't believed, and you can sort of chalk that up to just being a really small kid.
Yeah.
You know, Lori has her suspicions a couple times where she's like, who is this person that's following me? And she sort of sees Michael, you know, hiding behind the hedges and that sort of stuff, and spots him a couple times, but isn't really sure what's going on. Just thinks it's some weirdo on Halloween, you know, following her a little bit, not necessarily being a full on stalker at this point. And Tommy is the only one that truly sees Michael for what he is. And several times when he spots him, calls him the boogeyman, 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 which is eventually sort of the phrase that they go with by the end of it. By the end, you know, Lori and Dr. Loomis confirm that he is, in fact, the boogeyman. Yeah. But yeah, Tommy is the only person that actually sees him and is not believed, but it makes sense because he is a child. He's a small child and he's watching a horror movie on TV. Ironically, he's watching the original version of The Thing, which a few years later, Carpenter would go on to direct his remake of, which is pretty hilarious. I don't know if it's one of those he already knew he wanted to work on, or it just so happened to be fate of that's what he decided to put in the movie. I don't know, but I love it.
Oh, it's so great.
But yeah.
But yeah, and it's funny too, because they even kind of joke when Annie and Laurie are walking home, and Laurie says to Annie, oh, there's a guy behind the hedge or something. So Annie runs ahead and he's like, okay, jerk. And then she even jokes, he's like, he wants to take you out, because Laurie doesn't have a date for the dance the next night. So like, even they kind of don't have a sense of fear or worry about this, right? Like, it's always just some creepy guy or whatever. Or when she says, oh, I saw somebody in Mr. What's-His-Name's backyard, again, they make a joke about him, you know, being an old man. And it's like, oh, he couldn't, it's not like he could, you know, they make like, he could, the line is, you know, that's probably all he could do at this age is look, you know? So it's, they don't seem to see that there's any sort of threat following them, which, and I don't think there's really any reason for them to, which to your point is why it works so well. Cause it's not like they were attacked. It's not like there's a creepy note or anything left that you might've seen like in some of their films. Like, it's literally just, okay, we saw this guy who seems a bit odd, but there's no sense that, you know, you're in danger.
Yeah. And it's not even like something as glaring as a note or whatever. It's not like we've seen in movies where someone's literally just hiding in a corner or something like that, and they somehow miss seeing them. And it's like, how did you miss, you know, this, you know, blood dripping or, you know, the killer hiding in the corner, whatever. There's all of that stuff is purposely written in a way so that we never get those moments. So we never have to go, okay, why are we making these giant leaps of logic here?
Yeah, which again, just to your point, just shows the quality of this film and why it's held up so well.
Mm-hmm. I have to say my favorite kill in the movie is of Bob, which is the other boyfriend who
Linda's boyfriend,
yeah. You know, he's a little dismissive when he sees Michael. He's like, oh, what the hell is this guy doing here? And then so he starts getting choked and then lifted off the ground and then pinned into the wall with the knife, which, you know, is just so utterly brutal. And obviously, you know, isn't rooted in reality in the sense of someone able to lift someone up just by choking and then pinning them into the wall with a knife and them staying up like that. But none of that matters because it's done so well and like looks really cool the way they edit it together that you just sort of have to appreciate. And you're like, oh yeah, that's sort of like an all-time horror kill. And frankly, in my opinion, the kill of the movie.
Yeah, no, it's so great because he thinks it's someone just goofing around or something, right? Because he opens a couple doors and all of a sudden he opens the one door and Michael bursts out. And yeah, to your point, just kind of leaves him hanging there. And it's interesting too, just the way it shows, and I forget where I read this or someone was talking about, there's almost like a detachment from Michael in killing, because after he kills him, we kind of zoom out and you see Bob just pinned to the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Michael just kind of stands there and kind of turns his head and is just kind of looking at him. Like he's thinking, but it's just weird because you don't know what he's thinking about. There's not some sense of like I had to do this. It's just, you're looking at someone who's just so detached from, as Dr. Loomis says, we'll get into his famous speech later, but like, he's just so detached that he doesn't understand right or wrong. This is just something that's happened. And he's like, okay, now he's just looking at this body. And that's kind of the creepy essence of Michael Myers, is just, he's so detached.
And I think from what I know about the other Halloween films, where a sort of an accusation has been that Michael unfortunately turns basically into a superhero in the terms of superhuman strength. I wouldn't call him a superhero, I guess a supervillain. And I guess you can sort of point to that kill in particular as, okay, this guy is incredibly strong and powerful and can kind of, you know, have his way with people of a regular stature. Where you extrapolate it, and that's where unfortunately you get these superhuman feats of strength in the later films. Obviously, I haven't seen them. You've seen a chunk of them. Would you sort of agree with that assessment if that's where they get it from?
Yeah, and I think to your point, like if you look at the Rob Zombie one, the guy that plays Michael Myers is close to 7 feet tall, I think, or something. Like, he's huge. Like, he's just this gigantic guy. And I think what sets this apart, and I'll talk about the speech now for my as well. So one of my favorite parts, and I think what kind of set the template and what sets this movie aside from some of the others is when Dr. Loomis and Sheriff Brackett, it's the first time they go back to the Myers house. and they're upstairs. And to your point, just after when he pulls out the gun, and then Dr. Loomis gives this speech about, you know, I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another seven, you know, trying to keep him locked up because I realized, you know, what was living behind that boy's eyes was just purely simply evil. So you have this idea of someone who, to your point, he's not a supervillain, he's not anything else, he's just a human being who, if you removed all empathy, reason, morality from them, it's an interesting thought of like, well, what would we be capable of? And that's what makes him so scary, is that that's what Michael Myers is he's just a human being who has this basically completely removed from him. And the later movies, whether it was the Rob Zombie ones, which tried to go back and give him this backstory about, oh, he came from a lousy home and he was, you know, which you can read John Carpenter's own thoughts on that. And he has, of course, his own opinion. Or even the new ones with David Gordon Green's one, where it's kind of like he is like just this essence of evil and kind of becomes stronger the more he kills and the more evil he inflicts. He just becomes more of an evil presence and is just gains power almost. And so I, as much as I get kind of maybe why they want to go in a different direction, I think this is why the first one stands head and shoulders above the others, is because they didn't need to do that. They just had this human being who had this, you know, call it a defect. And that's what made him so scary, is it wasn't that he had powers. It wasn't that he was supernatural in any way. He was just a human being who had this removed. And you can ask, well, what would we be capable of if this was the case?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mentioned it earlier, the sort of psycho connections. And as someone who absolutely adores Alfred Hitchcock's films, and, you know, Psycho, I think, is one of the greatest films of all time. This movie came out 18 years after Psycho. And there's so many different connections that I see watching this. Obviously, the biggest one is the fact that you've got Jamie Lee Curtis, who is the daughter of Janet Lee, who is, you know, the infamous Marion Crane in Psycho, who dies halfway, you know, a third of the way through the movie, and, you know, completely reinvents the genre of what a horror movie is. And probably one of the first slashers, even though it's not really a slasher, it just so happens that, you know, the murder weapon of choice is a knife. So you got that sort of connection there. But then, you know, I got a few different things. You know, Dr. Sam Loomis is named after Sam Loomis, which is a character in Psycho. So obviously, you can't even hide the reference to Psycho there. And then there's also two shots in particular that I found that were basically shot-for-shot copies of what Hitchcock did. The first one, there's a scene early on where I can't remember which character it is. I didn't write down who it was, but someone tumbles down the stairs, which is exactly what happens in Psycho. And then also in the infamous closet scene, when Michael is breaking down the closet door, the light bulb in the closet is swinging back and forth, which is exactly what happens at the very end of Psycho as well. And it's now at the point where if you see a swinging light bulb in a horror movie, that's sort of what the original template reference is coming from. Obviously, things evolve and change. It might not be a direct homage. It might just be, hey, this is a scary trope that we've seen in another horror movie, so we're going to do it. But that's where it originates. So you can really tell that Carpenter was super influenced by Hitchcock and Psycho. And so it's really nice to see all this sort of come together where it feels very natural and loving and done in an admiration of respect. And so I really appreciate that. And obviously having Jamie Lee Curtis, as I said, the daughter of Janet Lee, is really cool. And, you know, something that has been, you know, talked about and broken down ad nauseum a million times since then, of, you know, what role does Jamie Lee Curtis have in, you know, the horror history, considering who her mother is and all that sort of stuff. But as a fan of Psycho, it was great to see.
Yeah. And I do think, to your point, Psycho, whether it meant to or not, it kind of did sort of become that first sort of slasher, right? Just because, and I mean, again, you see a lot of the shots where either, you know, the killer is kind of obstructed from view, or you don't necessarily see the violence, which I'm sure in part was just because of the ratings and when that movie was made. But, and even the nature of the killer, trying to figure out who the killer is, like all that sort of thing, that's kind of the template that followed in a lot of these movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny, I mentioned that I just watched Friday the 13th for the first time, and I watched that, and basically there's many moments in that movie where I'm just like, oh, this is basically just a remake of Psycho, just done a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Oh, no, which sure. I did not realize.
No, and that's the thing. Like, you can watch, and I mean, different horror movies do that too. Because I mean, there's The Shining, and then a friend of mine made the joke because we watched Event Horizon, and she's like, "Oh, it's just The Shining in space," because it takes place on the ship, right? And so I think that's the nice thing about horror is that, to your point, you can do these kind of homages or references or kind of loving, in a way, tributes, where you're not ripping off, but you're just putting your own stamp on something that's been done before, like the light bulb scene. I mean, I've read stuff, written stuff, seen stuff that is basically from other horror movies or movies I like, because that's stuff that you know will work or strike a chord or is just well done that you think, oh, okay, yeah, let's put it, do something like they did, but in a maybe not necessarily a more unique way, but just in a way that works with the story you're trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something absolutely about the fact that you can have a swinging light bulb. It doesn't matter what it's connected to. And obviously, as I said, it doesn't mean it's a ripoff of Psycho.
No.
But that said, you know, you insert something like that in your shot, it's a part of the filmic language that you understand as a filmmaker. That's what you're referencing. That's what you're pulling your DNA from, so to speak. So it makes sense where you can add little touches here and there where, you know, someone like Tarantino obviously is either, depending on how you feel about him, either lambasted because of how much he takes from his love of Asian cinema, or you really appreciate, you know, all these references that he's pulling from. It's just something that happens in film, especially when you're dealing with genre films.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think they especially lend themselves a lot more to that too, right? Because there's only, and not to crap over the, you know, the nature of these types of films or the genre, but there's only so much you can do. Like, people, like, to your point, your favorite kill and this or this, and, you know, Friday the 13th, which is the best kills, well, you know, you're kind of limited into the amount that you could do, especially with these lower budget predating, you know, big special effect kind of films where you had to be creative, you had to do stuff. Well, if people do something in that genre that works, well, yeah, other people are going to try and copy it or try and do it or do something similar, or maybe just like the new Halloween movies, maybe they do it in a similar way, but they just one up the gore because they can do it with better effects. Like, a lot of the kills, I would say, especially in like the David Gordon Green ones, it's Michael kills in a very similar way, but it's just more gruesome, more violent, more intense. And so They kept that the nature of the character intact while just being, you know, a bit more intense. Because I honestly think modern audiences want that more so than they were kind of prepared for back then. You know, I do feel like there's the nature of the horror audience, a certain sect, that just, you know, the slow burn like Halloween or something like that, you know, they want the more modern take where it is more violent, there's more action involved, as opposed to that development or the almost thriller nature of it, not the horror aspect, where it's that uncomfortable feeling, where it's the buildup, you know. Like, and that's why I think something like Get Out was so good, because there wasn't a ton of, you know, violence until, you know, the last little bit. It just built that uncomfortable feeling. It built the situation up so well.
I'd be curious if you have any thoughts on, you know, this movie. I don't know if Carpenter intended it to be so or not, but definitely sort of started a chain of movies where people, specifically women who have sex, are punished for that by being killed. In this case, Lori is the only one of her friends who isn't interested in having sex. And unfortunately, her three friends that are shown having sex or interested all die. And of course, you go back to the very beginning where 6-year-old Michael kills his sister. It's because she's having sex with her boyfriend when she should be babysitting him, all this sort of stuff. It doesn't feel, I've definitely seen some stuff where it's way more overt of, you know, the woman gets punished for having sex specifically. It doesn't feel as overt in this, but it's still very much present in understanding the trope of, maybe if this was the originator or not, I'm not totally sure, definitely of where it eventually leads to in the natural sort of conclusion. But do you have any feelings on the way that is set up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly been a trope, especially, you know, you look at like a lot of the 90s horror kind of stuff that was sort of prevalent. And Dario Argento, I know he's worked some of that in, and I'm sure if you look around to other Italian cinema, that's something that I don't know how much of it predates Halloween, but I'm sure some of it does. So I think it's something that has existed in a long while in film, or just that, I don't want to say puritanical nature, but just the nature of sin is brought into these movies. And I mean, Michael went after Laurie too. So it's not like he was like, oh, you didn't have sex, so you're off the hook. Like, he was trying to kill her as well. So the idea that, oh, she didn't have sex, so she's safe, wasn't necessarily true, because he was going after her. She just happened, you know, to survive. So I do think there's an unfortunate commentary that it's often the women who are punished for that, or seem to be being attacked. But I don't think it was, you know, something like you said, John Carpenter had any kind of direct correlation about.
Yeah, it almost more just seemed like a plot device on Laurie's end for a reason of why she wasn't going out with friends, and that she was the one stuck babysitting, because she was the only one that didn't care to go out partying or hang out with boyfriends or things like that. And so it made sense in a plot device to have her separated from her friends in that regard.
Yeah, and I mean, you talked about just watching Friday the 13th. I mean, it's way more overt in that one that, you know, oh, you campers were supposed to be watching my son.
Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, though, the, you know, spoilers for Friday the 13th, also a very old movie, the woman at the end who does end up surviving is interested in sex and talks about having boyfriends and had dated the camp owner before and stuff like that. So they sort of reverse that a little bit as well, where it's not the sort of trope of everyone that has sex is punished, even though all the other teens are having sex and they all get punished for in that sense. But that's more of the way they were setting up in terms of, you know, Jason's mother punishing the camp counselors for not watching the kids.
Yeah. And I mean, spoilers too, there's another line in Cabin of the Woods where there's a character that they're going to try and sacrifice people, and they're like, we need a virgin. And the girl's like, virgin. And then they're like, listen, we work with what we got. Because the girl is just not a virgin, but it, like, to your point, it gets into that whole, you know, purity, virginal thing. And they're making fun of the trope, which is one of the things I like about Cabin in the Woods, is it, you know, makes fun of and has a lot of fun with the conventions of the genre world. But yeah, it's one of those things that it sort of became a trope, even though it's not necessarily something that existed on purpose, but it just sort of fell into that place and then, you know, continued.
Yeah. It's sort of funny watching this movie and seeing the ending, where I love watching older movies. I watch a lot of older movies, but it's still something I never fully get used to, is just how abrupt older movies end. This movie ends where, you know, Michael is attacking Laurie in the closet. All this stuff happened. Dr. Loomis shows up. He shoots Michael a bunch of times. He falls out of the bedroom window and falls down in what we think to his death on the front yard. And Laurie's like, oh, is that the boogeyman? And the doctor's like, yes, it is. And then he goes and looks over the balcony, and Michael has disappeared. Dun, dun, dun. And then Laurie's just crying, and the doctor is very worried because he now knows that he has to track him down again. End credits. That's the end of the movie. Whereas now, if the movie was remade, which obviously we can point to the Halloween remakes, I haven't seen them, so I can't comment specifically on it, but that scene would happen, and then there'd be like an additional 10 minutes plus that happens afterwards of, okay, what is Laurie's life like now? How is she recovering from this trauma? What is Dr. Loomis going to do to try to find Michael? What happened with the rest of the town? Were the other bodies found? All this sort of stuff, where we actually get more details wrapped up and threads sort of closed. I love how older movies are just like, and that's the end. Credit roll.
Yeah. Well, no, it's absolutely brilliant, because it shows, like, I love how they just cut to different spots where maybe he's here, maybe he's here, he was here. Like, it gives you that sense of he could be anywhere. Like, that's the nature of the boogeyman, right? And so I really, I do love that it ended on that. And then you haven't seen two. So two literally picks up from that moment.
Okay.
And it literally, it's just like, okay, where is Michael? Like, Lori goes to the hospital because obviously she was injured. So he takes her to the hospital and then bang, like, two is like literally a direct continuation. Like, it's like 5 minutes after that happens, the ambulance pulls up and we, you know, that's part two. So to your point, I love that the first one does end like that because it didn't need, you know, where's Lori now? Where's Dr. Loomis now? Like, I think it's such a brilliant way to end it because it gives you that sense of sort of continuing dread in a way, you know, of like, yeah, this guy, he could be anywhere.
And honestly, it was surprising that it's a fairly bleak ending. Like, yeah, Lori survives, but like at what cost? And the fact is, Michael is still on the run, so obviously, you know, this terror is not over. At this point, we don't know if he's going to come back for Lori or not. You know, if I take myself to 1978 and I think about what was happening, I'd be like, oh, the ending. Okay, cool. So I imagine what would happen next is maybe Michael tries to get his revenge on. Obviously, that is what happens. But it's just the idea of, okay, now he's still out there and he can get anyone. It could be anyone that could be a victim. It could be you or me now.
Yeah. No, and that's the brilliance of it. And that's why so many great lines, like everyone's entitled to one good scare. Like, I think that's kind of a theme almost of this, where it's like, it's very, like, it could be you, it could be me. Like, there's this nature of Halloween is that, yeah, we're here to scare you. And I think that's what John Carpenter kind of wanted to do with the ending. He just didn't want to give, you know, some happy, neatly wrapped up sort of ending, because that would seem almost counterintuitive to what the rest of the movie was like.
Yeah. Well, that kind of goes through all of my notes. Is there anything else that you kind of want to bring up and touch on?
Personally, I'm just curious, again, as someone who just saw this for the first time, I'm curious sort of how you thought about, especially like the opening, because I really like how that was shot. And so in terms of the filming and how Michael's presented, how did that come across to you?
Yeah, like, so we get this perspective of Michael as a kid where, you know, he picks up a clown mask and puts it on, and you basically get the POV shot from inside the mask where you just see the two eye holes, and he, you know, he goes upstairs and stabs his sister, and it's all done through these two eye holes, which I think is a very effective way, a shot that later Steven Spielberg used for E.T. as well. I also just recently rewatched that, and there's the scene where E.T. gets dressed up as a ghost pretending to be little Gertie to go out trick-or-treating.
And he sees his buddy Yoda.
Yes, very funny. But exact same sort of shot where we just sort of get this like pinhole eye view POV shot done. And it's very effective because, you know, we get the heavy breathing. We feel like voyeurs because we are the ones that are doing the killing at this point. And so it's very effective in that regard. And I think it also does a great job of also hiding what we can't see, in the sense of it allows Carpenter to sort of not have to worry about, you know, showing little Michael's sister being covered in blood, that, you know, she's topless in this scene. He goes up, she's naked and clean, obviously. She gets stabbed a bunch of times. We sort of, like, because of the shakiness of the camera a little bit and the limited visibility, we sort of lose sight of her, and then she pops back into frame again and she's completely covered in blood. So it's nice that Carpenter's able to mask the filming and not have to worry about, you know, doing very expensive shots or multiple angles and lots of cuts and editing and all that sort of stuff, that it can do it all in camera at once and make it so effective without losing any of the tension that's going on.
And then the reveal that it's a kid.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we don't know this at the time. And then he goes outside, and then we see a car pull up and two adults come out. And then the parents are a little surprised, like, what's going on? And then we finally get the cut and the reverse shot. And we see that it's just a little child wearing a clown costume, having a bloody knife in his hand.
Yeah. And I think, again, that gets to the whole nature of what Dr. Loomis, and again, I think that speech kind of set the template, which, you know, later things of the franchise, like, there's one, Paul Rudd, famously, one of his first movies was Halloween 6, and it's about, like, the druids, there's a curse, and Michael Myers is, like, the culmination of this and evil, and it's that sort of thing, again, just, it, I mean, I get why people want to try and do something different with the franchise, but I just think this first one is so perfect on its own because, that, to your point, they didn't try and do too much. They didn't try and create something that was, you know, you had to suspend, as I said earlier, suspend a lot of disbelief. It was just really straightforward. And the other thing that I'm always curious about when people watch this is the fact that Michael doesn't talk. Does that work for you?
Yeah, it's not really something I sort of considered. I think it adds to the creepiness because Michael is just a complete blank slate. The only thing we know about him is what other people say. You know, it sort of goes back to an acting technique. When you're trying to figure out who your character is, you go through the script and you sort of highlight anytime someone talks about your character and how they describe you, that's how you have to present that character. Because you can make all the internal choices you want and all that sort of stuff that makes sense for you, but you have to convince these other characters a reason to say these lines. Why are they describing you in this fashion? And so because Michael is a complete blank slate, he doesn't need to worry about presenting himself in any other way. We have the other characters describing him. We have Dr. Loomis, who describes him in pretty vivid detail several times. And then we also have, when we finally have, like, Tommy calling him the boogeyman, things like that. That's all we need to know about him. He doesn't need to talk and say, I am the boogeyman, I'm here to kill you, all that sort of stuff, because we have the other characters projecting that onto Michael.
Yeah. And I'll give a shout out to the guys who do the Writer's Blockbuster podcast. They've talked about this a lot, and they call it the praise of the killer speech, which, you know, when Dr. Loomis is talking about Michael, you know, you see something like that with Ash in Alien, or with Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, or with, you know, it's Quint in Jaws. How, to your point, like, in the script, when other characters or people are talking about you, that kind of presents who this character is. You don't need the character to kind of talk about themselves or present themselves in that way. And so we have this idea of Michael Myers very early on, just from what Dr. Loomis has said and the way he reacts. And so I think it serves the movie and serves the character well, and just adds to the overall effectiveness. If you just have this guy who's silent, doesn't need to say or do anything, like the part where, he just puts a sheet over himself and pretends to be Bob. Like, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good scene. And, like, now, obviously, watching it, we've seen that trope before where someone's, yeah, you know, masking themselves as someone else. So, unfortunately, a lot of these things, we now recognize what they're going for. But at the time, it works. It's, you know, the scene maybe is just, like, a hair too long of Bob not speaking. And so, you know, as an audience, we're going, okay, yeah, we know that there's something not right. We've already seen Bob die, so we know that this is Michael. Yeah. If that scene, that would be my only sort of complaint, where if that scene was maybe shortened just a little bit, so that way, who's the girl on the scene? What's her name?
Linda.
It's not Linda.
Yeah, Linda? Linda. Okay, that's his girlfriend. So yeah, it's your point. If she picks up the phone, you know, 20 seconds earlier or something, you know,
yes, it would have been, exactly,
wouldn't have taken anything away.
100%. Yeah, that's a very, very minor critique, and it's definitely built on John Carpenter wanting to add suspension of wondering what's going to happen next, because the audience knows that's Michael. Linda doesn't know it's Michael. What's going to happen? So we know what's happening. We know it's going to be something bad for her, but he's just sort of drawing it out and playing with the audience's emotions at that point.
And you know, it's an old movie because they used to have to remember which phone number to dial.
Yes. But of course, back then, you know, we all had numbers memorized. I know as a kid, you know, you'd have to have your home, your grandparents, your next door neighbor, you know, you'd have about 10 numbers that you had memorized at all times.
Yep, absolutely. And I think I do like the kind of tie in there too, where it's like Lori, you know, she thought Annie was an obscene phone call, which added to the tension, yes, in the scene where she sees Michael in the sheets. And then she gets this other phone call and she's like, okay, yeah, you're kidding around again. Like, I do like how that was a nice callback.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounded like she was having sex on the phone. Like, it really did sound, whether it was supposed to be Linda faking that she was having sex or actually having sex, it sounded real. And Lori wasn't sure, was it a fake obscene call or a real obscene call, in the sense of she wasn't sure the legitimacy of her moaning, so to speak, which I thought worked really well. But it was believable enough as an audience that, you know, you can very easily confuse, you know, her moans as a sign of struggle and losing oxygen because she's being strangled versus moans of pleasure.
Yeah. And I mean, she also thought it was her friend's goofing because she was waiting to get that call. And they were, okay, I'm back. You know, you can bring Lindsay back over or whatever, right? So she just assumed. And we're led, like, we have no reason for us to, I mean, we do because we know what's going on. But if we were in Lori's position, we would have no reason to think that that's not the phone call, right?
Yeah, which sort of continues with this, you know, we've been harping on it nonstop, the logical consistency of this movie. Everything makes sense, which is always the biggest criticism of horror movies, is the logic just doesn't make sense most of the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So do you have any last things you want to touch on before we end up there?
No, I just, like I said, I think you've kind of articulated it really well, how just from start to finish, how well done it was, from the performances, the directing, the writing. I think, you know, all those things hold up so well and were just so well executed, especially, I mean, you don't want to say especially because of the budget, but I remember reading, because they filmed it in Pasadena too, right? So they're like, well, how are we going to make Pasadena look like, you know, Illinois in the fall? So there was a lot of little things they had to deal with, and they pulled it all off really well.
Mm-hmm. And something that's not distracting. No. Like, apparently there's several shots of palm trees in the background. I didn't notice it. Obviously, you know, I work in film now, so I'm used to seeing, you know, leaves brought in to sort of, you know, set the tone of what the, the season is supposed to be. So. Mm-hmm. But it all sort of works in the end. I watched it and I wouldn't say I was like in love with it. I did really like it and really appreciate it. I think it's a movie that maybe I'm going to need to watch another time or two to sort of like, you know, really be fully on board with my appreciation of it. I don't think I'll ever get to the level that you're at, but it definitely made me want to continue watching at least the original movies. I don't know if I'm ready yet for either the zombie or the green movies yet, but definitely curious, especially to get to Halloween 3. I've heard so much about it, and it definitely seems that it's been getting reappraised, you know, in the last decade or so, as far as people coming out of the woodwork and being like, hey, you know what? I actually kind of like this movie. It's weird. It doesn't follow the rest of the movies. If you were to call it literally anything else, just call it The Season of the Witch, not Halloween 3, it'd be a great movie. It probably would have been a hit. But, you know, because it's got the Halloween baggage and didn't live up to it, it unfortunately fell out of favor and didn't make money, but I'm still very curious to watch
it. And I was listening to a podcast the other day. They were talking about that specifically within the Halloween genre. And it's funny because, to your point, if it would have just been a standalone, it probably wouldn't have had all that, like you said, baggage to deal with. But that's why 4 is literally called The Return of Michael Myers, so that people knew, oh no, we're going back.
We're sorry. We made a mistake. He's back.
Please get your, your money. Exactly. Please get your checkbook out.
All right. Well, Brody, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your love and passion about this movie. I really appreciate getting the chance to talk it out with you. And I'm glad you finally bullied me into watching it.
Like I said, everyone's entitled to one good scare. So I'm glad you're on board, and I'm glad that you weren't traumatized. I am glad that you enjoyed the movie. And I mean, I kind of, you know, Rachel, Alex, we all kind of joke about it, I know Matthew too, but like it is a movie that someone like you, who has such an appreciation and understanding for film, I knew you would like it to at least some degree, because it is just so well crafted, so well done, and there's so much you could take away from it. And I mean, obviously it's easy for us now looking back at, you know, except 45 years later, all the movies that have come since and been like, oh, okay, so this happened and this is kind of a trope, but they were so well executed in this that it didn't seem kind of, you know, cheesy at the time. It didn't seem kind of like the easy thing to do. Like, it just legitimately seemed like, oh yeah, this is what would have happened given these circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, there has been a bunch of reviews that have been posted on the ContraZoom website, ContraZoomPod.com. Paulo Bautista has been covering the New York Film Festival for us, and there's a bunch of reviews, and there's also going to be a bonus episode coming out with his overall thoughts coming soon. And Brody, you yourself actually wrote a review for the new documentary, Joan Baez, I Am Noise, about the legendary singer. If you want to give a quick little preview about what you thought of the movie, and is it worth checking out for people?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. I didn't know a whole lot about Joan Baez. I mean, obviously, I kind of knew who she was a bit as an artist and an activist, but that's really about all I knew. So I definitely think this is one that if you're a casual fan or someone just had to, you know, kind of glimpse of to who she was like myself, you'll enjoy. And I think people who really are fans of her will, you know, they'll get more out of it even, you know, obviously than someone who doesn't, because it just paints such a really interesting picture of a very intriguing life. Like, I didn't know all, you know, the kinds of ups and downs in her life, the mental health stuff she'd been through, all necessarily the activist stuff she was involved in. Like, it was really interesting to get her opinion. And I think she's just someone who speaks very openly and honestly about, you know, what she went through. So definitely if you have some interest in that or the music of the time or her, her story, you'll, I think you'll enjoy it.
Nice. Well, that will be linked in the show notes for people to read, and hopefully they check it out and let us know what they think about the movie once it does come out. You also are a screenwriter. I will link to your show, The Gift, in the show notes. Is there anything else you want to promote, or if people want to follow you, what's the best way to do so?
No, that's kind of all the stuff I got going right now. Best way to follow me is just on any social media. Just my name, Brody Cottenham, and yeah, I'm still working on the screenwriting stuff, so got a few things in the fire. If anything comes of that, I'll be sure to let you know.
Fantastic. We, of course, will always share that for you.
Well, I appreciate that.
This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. What do you think of Halloween in the franchise as a whole? Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smale for the theme music, and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on Ko-fi. Thanks for checking us out. Thank you.